From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in Minnesota, in a video where a group of children are gleefully swarming the governor, Tim Walz. Maybe you've seen this moment on video. It's been a regular staple of the Harris-Walz presidential campaign. The video comes from the day that Governor Walz signed into law a piece of legislation guaranteeing Minnesota children the right to breakfast and lunch if their families can't provide it for them. Walz likes to say that this is an act of government that is explicitly about making kids' lives better. Ohio Senator J.D. Vance has different ideas into what government should be doing. Vance is, of course, the Republican candidate for vice president. He favors the kinds of policies that, in his words, penalize people for not having children and rewarding people for having children. Vance is concerned that, first of all, the average American woman is now having 1.6 children, and that number falls below the birth replacement rate of 2.1 children. And that means that the American population is likely to eventually decline unless women start having more kids. And much of Vance's focus over the past several years has been on raising birth rates. His comments about people who don't have children have gotten all kinds of attention. He defends those comments, and he says he is simply concerned about the future of the country. But Vance has also made clear that he doesn't want just anyone raising kids. He doesn't love the idea of supporting parents by funding more daycare. He wants to see more kids cared for directly by their parents and grandparents, which is the arrangement that has been made in his own family. Vance has talked about how his wife's mother has stepped away from a successful teaching career to focus on helping care for Vance's three young children. I've been wondering what someone like Pete Nabosny thinks of all this. He's the director of policy for the Children's Agenda. It is not at all a partisan organization. He works with lawmakers at various levels. He's worked with Democrats and Republicans, of course. And the kinds of debates happening in this campaign could dramatically affect the work of organizations like the Children's Agenda. I'm talking about policy debates. I'm also talking about cultural debates, and this hour it's a chance to discuss what a children's agenda might look like no matter who wins in November. Pete Nabosny, Policy Director for the Children's Agenda. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I'm going to state it right outside the top here. If listeners are hoping that I or Pete are going to be, you know, critical of a campaign or, you know, get granular or, you know, that's not what this is really about. I was thinking about all the ways that we are hearing these conversations about who has kids and who doesn't, and what that means for the future of the country, and what that means for kids, and what policies are supported and what are not, and what the government can pay for and what it can't pay for. And I thought about you, and I'm wondering if you feel any differently in this presidential campaign. You've seen lots of campaigns now. You know, you're getting older. You can't help it. I'm getting older,
That's
too.
That's right. Got some gray in my beard now.
Do you feel any differently about this one to begin with?
Yeah, it's certainly been really interesting to watch the discussion of what it means to be pro-family, for example, or pro-child, or to have this much discussion on children's issues and family issues at the center of the campaign. That's very different than we've seen. I mean, if we look back 4 years ago, obviously we were in the midst of a pandemic. There was a lot going on with that. There was also a broader, I think, you know, campaign around Donald Trump directly and his presidency. And, you know, prior to that, I mean, if you look back at the past couple of elections, things are about immigration or healthcare or the economy more broadly. And for a variety of reasons, this one seems to have – it's obviously touching on many things. Not all issues under discussion are things that I work on. But certainly it's had more attention on the issues that the Children's Agenda cares about than any presidential campaign that I can recall.
Well – let me talk about some of the broader themes here before we get into individual policy ideas here. First of all, I'm not going to ask you to comment on this idea that people who don't have children are, you know, don't have a stake in the future of the country. I don't think that's fair. You know, and the vice presidential candidate on the Republican side has had a lot to say about that. He has said various times that he thinks childless people tend to be psychotic or deranged or selfish. You know, that's he's got the right to believe those things. I do want to ask you about one of the broader themes he brings up a lot, and that's the subject of a birth rate. And, you know, this is not something that I've studied a lot until recently because it's come up a lot recently. So first, this is what J.D. Vance says about the birth rate. Quote, even among healthy, intact families, they're not having enough kids such that we're going to have a long-term future in this country, end quote. First of all, the Wharton School recently performed an analysis. They found that even if things stay the same, this country will sustain positive population growth through the year 2100. It is definitely true that the population would eventually decline if the birth rate stays where it is and if net immigration doesn't change. But the biggest immediate challenge will be a country that does not see its population collapse, but instead it sees its population get significantly older in the next century. As we've mentioned, one way to supplement American population in the event that the birth rate stays low is by having robust immigration. J.D. Vance opposes that. He wants more American women having more kids. North Carolina state economists, for example, say that with a low birth rate, there could eventually be a shortage of workers to support an older workforce. And since saving is typically done by younger people, some economists think stagnant or declining population growth would lead to lower savings, hence higher interest rates for borrowers, all of those things. I mean, I'm looking at all of these different spiral effects. This is not my expertise at all. Generally speaking, does birth rate concern you at all? Is that something you think about?
I'd say it's not something I think about a tremendous amount. Although
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, because it has been in the news, I've had to kind of think through my, I guess, personal perspective on it. The Children's Agenda, we haven't put out a report on the birth rate in Monroe County, and I don't think we plan to do so. You know, and our perspective is we're interested in enhancing the well-being of children in our community and in communities all across New York. And we don't get into decisions about when and why and all that in terms of and how many children to have. We're pretty agnostic on that. I will say you went through a bunch of things there, but there are a lot of concerns different people have around population growth. In the past, you know, 60, 70 years ago, there was a lot of concern about overpopulation that continued for a while. And that as soon as that concern started to ebb, you started seeing people beginning to talk about these issues of declining birth rates, particularly in more developed countries. But you're seeing it happening all over the world. And I'm not going to speculate on all the causes of that. And I think there's a lot going into that. But I guess my personal perspective is that I'd like to see a culture and a society and a set of government policies that help people have the number of children that they intend to have, whether that's, you know, 0, 1, 2, or however many more. And so when we're looking at public policy issues like things like a child tax credit or supporting things like paid family leave or all sorts of other policies, we look at it with that in mind. If families can't have children and they would like to because they can't figure out how to afford it, I think there's ways that government policy can help them afford it. If they can't find housing, well, then, you know, we need to be doing some things around housing. Kids take up more space. There's, you know, we have a need for more kind of family size housing, things like that. But we don't, and I personally don't get too into the sort of the bigger kind of cultural implications of this, nor do, there's more issues involved in the declining birth rate in America than just some of these public policy issues. And, you know, it takes a couple people to have a kid. So if there's a challenge that people are having, you know, in terms of finding the right partner and things like that, that's not something that I encounter with my work. And but I do think there's interesting findings out there around all those things. And it's certainly something that I like to read about and start to think through my opinion of, I suppose.
Well, I want to approach this from a different angle that's closer to the kind of the line of work that you do. I hear people like J.D. Vance talking frequently about how big a problem the birth rate is. They're genuinely concerned about it. And what I don't often hear them talk about is why younger adults are choosing to have fewer kids. And my lay instinct is to say, before you try to use the law or taxes or a loan forgiveness program or shaming to steer people into having more kids, I would suggest listening to young adults right now. Ask them why they're viewing things differently, why they're pessimistic. I mean, the act of having kids is an act of optimism, I think. And the birth rate is itself is a kind of measure of optimism. In one sense, not the only thing it is, but in one way, I think it is. I think pessimism leads to smaller families. And I don't think young adults are as optimistic about the future as their parents and and grandparents are. And, you know, sometimes they'll tell you that they're worried about climate change and they're worried about what the world looks like in the future. Sometimes they will just generally talk about the doomy nature of politics kind of writ large or war. But I think it's important to ask them why. And, you know, I don't know how specifically you've delved in that at the Children's Agenda, but I would have to think that part of that is also a pessimism that they can feel like they've got the supports, the job they need, the housing they need. All those things probably impacts that decision, right? Doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah. From what I've read, I mean, I think that, like you said, there's a lot of things going on there and a lot of people make different choices.
There's not just one reason.
Yeah,
of course,
lots of different reasons. I think there are a couple long-term patterns that we're seeing in some of the data and that, you know, I've certainly read about a bit. One thing that I think a lot of people, including myself, would point to as a real public health success story over the last generation or so is the declining teenage birth rate. And then beyond that, you have more women waiting to have kids until they're a bit older. And the sort of average age of first birth has increased pretty steadily over the past couple decades. And there's lots of reasons for that. Some of it is around kind of planning, and some of it's around careers, and some of it's around education, and some of it's about finding the right partner. And there's a lot of other factors that I've, you know, read about and there's been some research on. And you know, so there's people are sort of some folks are delaying. Other folks have made a choice that they don't intend to have kids. And then some families are choosing to have fewer children than they did in the past. But again, to the extent that there's a way for government policy or, you know, again, we don't do too much on sort of these cultural issues and whatnot. But if there's a way that we can make it easier for families to have the number of children that they want to have, then I think that's a good thing. I've got two kids. I think we're pretty set. we're good, and I think that's fine for my family. But if you know, if someone really would like that third child and they can't figure out how to afford it, I think that's something we should be listening to. In the same way that if somebody chooses not to have children for a variety of reasons, that's something that we should respect and kind of leave it there. But I do think there's a lot of sociological things going on, and as they always are in America right now, that are affecting some of the rates that you see at a top level there.
Pete mentioned the declining teen birth rate, which is a success story. The 10 American states with the highest rates of teen birth are New Mexico, Texas, West Virginia, Alabama, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Kentucky, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Mississippi. Pretty much the contiguous American South, particularly the Southeast. And there's a lot that goes into that. That's a whole other conversation. I mean, those are also the states that have the highest rates of the most commonly used abstinence-only education, for example, the least amount of comprehensive sex ed, et cetera. So there's a lot of reasons for that. But there's no doubt that a declining teen birth rate overall is a success story. I also don't want to make it seem like, well, what are the policy issues that would lead people to have more kids? Some of it's cultural, right? I mean, like, it's hard to account for a changing culture in the moment.
Yeah.
But certainly, I think that there are cultural reasons that might go beyond policy. That's logical, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, America went through a period of lower birth rates prior to World War II, and a lot of that was driven by the Great Depression, which historically, I mean, going back long histories, people have fewer children during times of war and times of famine and recession and things like that. But we had this period of really increased births after World War II. To your point earlier, there was this, I think, sense in America of optimism,
yeah,
and this kind of new American hegemony and all these other things in the world, and you had this explosion of consumer culture and building of suburbs and tremendous affluence for a whole bunch of reasons, including like the destruction of much of the rest of the world. But so that
it was a baby boom.
Yeah, it was the baby boom, right? And And that was a much, and you also had far higher rates of infant surviving, right? You had the adoption of antibiotics, you had all sorts of medical advances, you had more mothers surviving childbirth. So there was a whole bunch of factors that came together, technology, culture, the economy, and it led to a much higher birth rate. And then you had a lot of other changes after that. You know, you had birth control and you had a feminist revolution and more women entering the workforce. And you had different economic conditions at different times. And the birth rate kind of went up and down, generally kind of on a downward trajectory from the high in the 50s. And yeah, these things are all really complicated. And I think it's hard to sort of isolate, you know, specifics, but certainly technology, science, culture, and politics, and I think a sense of sort of the state of the country in general have some influence on whether or not people make a pretty big decision of whether to have a child or a second or a third or a fourth child. I also just think, you know, one thing I've noticed, and I think there's a lot of research on it, that people who come from big families are more likely to have larger families. And I think that points to some of those cultural factors. Folks who are highly religious, who are very connected to their church and their faith community, are more likely to have often, depending on the faith tradition, more children. And so, yeah, these things are all culture, and you could point to some of the maybe declines in church attendance and things like that as driving some of this too. But these things are all pretty interwoven from my understanding of the issues.
I'm going to get to one place where at least the political campaigns may have some agreement, although we haven't seen formal policy proposals in all that much detail on a child tax credit. But that's something that Pete's talked about a lot. We're going to get to that in just a second. Before we do that, though, one other aspect of this that that I've had to try to read up and really try to understand a little bit better, and some of it comes from Senator Vance, and some of it comes from just reading some of the other, I would say, conservative Christian leaders. I mean, it's not a monolithic school of thought on who raises kids. There's plenty of conservative Christians who would support either daycare subsidies, child care support, et cetera. But there seems to be a growing idea that it's not a great idea just to subsidize more daycare or child care, because that's not your family raising those kids, and that's not good quality, and that's not what you should want. You should want the parents to raise the kids or the grandparents or an extended family. That should be both the cultural demand and maybe supported with whatever policy levers you could push in that direction, although I'm not sure what that would look like. But, you know, for J.D. Vance himself, he has talked about his wife Usha's mother, who very successful teaching, I think, in California, took leave to come help raise their three kids. And he's raved about that and how important that's been for his family. And I think that is truly wonderful. I think that it is an outstanding thing when families can stay connected and support each other, because raising kids is tough. But that's also not possible for everybody. What do you make of this idea that daycare, childcare is not a good thing to support with subsidies, with more funding? Because that's not the parents and that's not the family raising kids, and that should not be the standard.
Yeah, so the Children's Agenda and myself, my work, we've done a lot of work over the years to work to expand funding for child care assistance, to help more families access it, to help ensure that parents can get to work, that they can hold down a job or pursue an education, different things are going on in their life, and that their children can be in a safe, nurturing, consistent care environment while they're doing that. We do have policies in New York State that allow, and this is different than some other states, and so this isn't a uniform federal issue, but allow grandparents, aunts, uncles, neighbors, close family friends to care for a child with, you know, and receive assistance from the government if it's helping that parent who qualifies for assistance to go to work or to, you know, pursue their education, things like that. And Monroe County actually has one of the highest rates of that care arrangement in the state.
That's interesting.
It's not well known, and I think a lot of it gets sort of communicated through word of mouth and things like that. But it is an option that's available for people. I mean, I think it should be. I think my goal would be that families have as many choices as they can find, whether it's in a child care center, family-based child care, with a relative, or if their circumstance allows it for a parent, if that's what they choose to do, to be able to stay at home. I think that's sort of respecting people's agency and figuring out what the best arrangement for themselves and their children are. It's not like that everywhere in the country. Certain states don't allow those close family members to care for a child and receive assistance while doing that. And I think, to your point, I think that these issues are really complicated, right? I think lots of people are in a situation for a variety of reasons. It could be because they're estranged from their family. It could be because they live far away from relatives. It could be because their parents are still working and can't afford to retire and start looking after the grandkids. It could be because one partner or the other, the caretakers can't afford to leave work because they have housing costs and all sorts of other things. And decisions about where to and what to do with childcare are pretty complicated and they're pretty personal. And so I think the best public policy is to listen to families and to have a set of supports that respect their choices and move on from there.
It does not strike me as a mainstream American position to say that it's a bad thing if kids are going to daycare. I think a lot of people would say, I can't afford daycare, or I'd like help paying for it, or I'd like daycare workers to get paid more. I'd like the whole system to be better. But I don't think most people think, well, that's a bad thing for kids if you're going to daycare.
Yeah, I think some people would say my ideal situation, and there's some polling around this, is I wish I could stay home with my kids, but I can't afford to.
Absolutely.
And so therefore, I found
I don't think they view that as equal to parents.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. But no, I think, and if you go and you talk to parents about their child care arrangements, you'll get a variety of perspectives. Some love it, and some lean so heavily on their provider that, a former coworker of mine was a longtime family child care provider, and she would tell stories about getting invited to, kids' high school graduations, a decade plus later, because she built those relationships with those families. Others have a hard time. Others have a difficult time. And kids, in different environments, kids from, can struggle sometimes with the social setting, and some kids really thrive in it. And so, every family and every child is different, but there's a lot of research that shows that high quality, consistent, nurturing childcare can be really supportive for that child and their development, and then also for that parent, and removing a lot of parental stress by that parent knowing that their kid's going to be in a safe, nurturing place. That's really key for overall family functioning and for that, that child's well-being and getting off to the best possible start to life.
Let me ask then just like the policy angle to this then. If we were going to go in a direction as an American society where we wanted to see more kids raised directly by parents and grandparents or parents and aunts and uncles and family and less kids in daycare, I don't know that you could get there just culturally. My lay perspective is that would require some serious policy measures to help people get there. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would take some significant policy measures and significant public investments. Someone making minimum wage in New York is, making, north of $30,000 a year now if they're working around full time. When we're talking about these expansion of child tax credits, we're talking about a couple thousand dollars per child. So if you've got a couple kids, maybe it's, we're talking $6,000, $8,000, $10,000. Depending on the proposal and the age of the kids, but that's not going to replace the wages that person is earning. On the other hand, they have costs associated with working and childcare costs and things like that. So there's some offsets there, but and again, not everything comes down to income, not everything comes down to those decisions. But there is a lot that would need to change. But then again, there's a lot of parents who, love and adore spending time with their kids, and they don't have that grandparent who's available for a variety of reasons, and you know, their choices that they, you know, they want to be able to continue pursuing their career and having their kids in this care environment, and they view that as helping them be a better parent. You know, just because a child's in childcare doesn't mean that the parent's not doing a tremendous amount of work, as I've learned over the past couple of years. And so, so yeah, I think it's hard to imagine a future in which that's, you know, a robust, well-resourced childcare system isn't a piece of the puzzle for a lot of families.
Okay. One other question on this before we get into some other policy ideas. And listeners, if you want to join the conversation, we're talking to Pete Nabosny, Policy Director for the Children's Agenda. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. This is a little outside the scope of what I told you we were going to talk about.
Great.
So I suspect you're going to say, we don't really have a position on that. But I want to ask you anyway, because it is related to some of this movement toward changing the cultural norms for how kids are raised and who does the raising of the kids and family structures, et cetera. In the traditional Catholic mindset, I think characterized pretty well by people like Patrick Deneen, who has written a number of books, and his most recent book talks about some of the damage in his idea of what he thinks are way too loose divorce laws. He thinks we should get rid of no-fault divorce. The goal, in his words, is keeping kids in households where their parents are still together. And there are too many kids who are not with both of their biological parents. And divorce is a problem, and we need to have less divorce. J.D. Vance's own grandparents stayed together. He wrote a book about it, of course. Turns out that his grandmother had filed for divorce twice. It didn't end up happening. There was some concern about violence, but they stayed it out. And J.D. Vance says it was great that they did for the whole family. When Deneen says things like, you know, no-fault divorce is damaging to kids, or we should actually pursue laws that make it harder to get divorced, does the Children's Agenda have a position on that?
I could go back and check. I'm pretty sure we haven't taken a stance on divorce laws in New York. And yeah, that's we're focused on sort of the what's good for kids and what policies are good for kids. And I think discussions of divorce laws are pretty outside of our scope. I will say that there's a lot of research out there that shows that economic strain for families can lead to divorce. So I think finding ways to support families is really important. And to the extent that there's things we can do that reduce some of the stress that parents are feeling that can lead to divorce, that's something that we should be prioritizing. But no, we haven't taken a stance on no fault divorce, and I don't think we're gonna
that's not
going
to
today.
Not high on the list. Yeah. Well, but you're bringing up an interesting point, which is the chicken and egg thing. It's if you want more kids with both biological parents, if you want households that don't have divorce and strong families, do you pass a law that makes it simply harder to get divorced and then walk away and say, well, that's better? Or do you say, how come at least some, every household is different, every relationship is different, why is this happening more often? Are there policy levers that would allow families to resolve some of the biggest strain they have, which is often financial? So I think it's a chicken and egg thing. So
yeah, and I think there's the other side of it too, which is, do we have policies in place that, and we see this in some of our public assistance policies, which effectively discourage marriage through, like for example, the earned income tax credit. If you have two parents making $25,000 a year and they've got a couple kids, if they're not married, they will receive a much, much larger, thousands of dollars more of a earned income tax credit. You know, when they file for the taxes, they get that large refund than if they are married, where they'd get essentially nothing at this point. And so there are things like that that I think we should look at and, you know, adjust those policies where we can so that a family doesn't, you know, a family that is, you know, together and they would like to memorialize that in law and at their, you know, church perhaps and things like that, they shouldn't feel discouraged through public policy to do so. But I think that's, you know, that's different than saying we're going to make it much harder for a couple who has reached a point where they feel like they can't be together to stick it out. That's something that I think we're not quite ready to touch.
All right, Jane in Rochester on the phone. Hello, Jane. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Evan. J.D. Vance, you said this, women are not having enough children. It's interesting to me he didn't say couples are not having enough children. And it's just the way I think. I can't help it.
So in that language, you hear him talking about
women
exerting some
women
control.
Are not
okay.
doing what they need to do.
Okay.
He didn't say couples. He said women are not having enough children. Enough children for what?
To continue the population of this country without a decline.
We're doing that. We're having all these immigrants come in, and we can't house and feed them. I don't understand that. We, it seems like in some places we're overpopulated.
Again, this is a little far afield, but Vice President candidate J.D. Vance's viewpoint on that has been I'm trying to summarize here.
Mm-hmm.
He does not view immigration as a solution for that. He sees higher birth rates.
Of course not.
Okay.
I see a little racism, that sort of thing in this too. He wants nice, white little children. That's what I suspect in this. Why would he, in women?
He's not married to a white woman. I mean, that it should be noted.
I'm talking about what he said. I can only go about that. But I'm not comfortable with that at all. They did that in the 50s. You know, everybody had to be married. And a lot of people got married just to have that little halo of conformity. You know, you've heard it over and over. Oh, he's a family man. But he's not much of a husband or a father. But it gave you status. And I don't want to get back to where women think, that they're pressured. They feel a social pressure. And I went through that myself, living in the South. You know, I got all this. Well, all I ever wanted was children. I don't know what's wrong with you. That's because you're not me. But anyway, I'm really antsy about this. But the reason probably a lot of people don't have children is right now, I would guess, how unstable everything has been for the last 30 years. I mean, you think of your own life. You don't know next week what's going to happen sometimes.
Sure.
People get laid off, 40,000 people at a time. That was Bill Gates, one of his last layoffs, 40,000 people. I think it was in Colorado. It's scary to commit, and that commitment is one of the most important you will ever make in your life. And you don't want stress on you. It should come from a healthy, confident, a mature couple who thinks it through thoroughly, because someone's life depends on it. I like your program, Evan, but it's one of those things that just I had to work through it myself. And
it's okay.
Good show.
Thank you, Jane. Yeah. So Jane didn't use the word, but maybe optimism is part of it. Young people people of any age who want to get married need to have optimism to believe that it's going to work, to feel like that you can make it work. You know, Pete Nabosny from the Children's Agenda made a point earlier this hour that there's all kinds of reasons that people would not be having kids. And there is some research into this. I mentioned everything from how young people might see issues like climate change to war. That does come up in surveys. It does not come up in the surveys I've seen as the chief driver. The chief driver is people will say, well, we're not having kids because we can't afford it. That's the number one. I don't think that has changed in forever, Pete.
Yeah, certainly affordability is always right there. I do think if you read some social conservatives around some of this, I know New York Times columnist Ross Douthat has written about this. There is a cultural change that's happened over time, which I tend to think has some insight where in the 1950s, what we were talking about, what Jane was mentioning, there was a sense that getting together, finding that partner, getting married, having children was sort of a cornerstone of an adult life, right? That you find that person and you start your life with them, and then you have kids, and maybe you have kids a lot earlier. And I think there's been some cultural changes around over time, but that a lot of people see of having getting married and having children as like a capstone, right? So once you've kind of got established in your life, then you're ready for that change. And at that point, you start looking at your finances and you're looking, and maybe you've had a child or two and you're sort of at a different place. And so, and a lot of people feel like they're struggling to get to that place. They haven't quite figured out what they're going to do with their life and what their career is going to look like. And maybe they've experienced some layoffs, like Jane mentioned. And if, you know, that person who may want to have kids doesn't feel like they're there yet, that they've really arrived in a stable place, then they may, you know, choose to continue to put it off. And at, you know, some point it becomes harder to have children. And again, that's from the perspective of someone who maybe wants to have kids but feels they can only do it when they're ready. That is like a cultural, I think, shift that's happened. And, you know, I think reading about it a bit and, you know, I tend to buy that. Whether what we can do about that and whether the old way was a better way or that this is a better way, that's people's kind of own perspective. But to the extent that we have policies through our education system and through government policy and housing policy and things like that, that maybe help people feel like they're a bit more in place, a bit younger, I think that's certainly something with some merit.
I think we've got a piece of sound that we can listen to now, because I want to talk a little bit more about actual policy proposals. And there's not a ton so far in this campaign. There's a lot of rhetoric, and that's why we discussed sort of the broad strokes of these issues with Pete Nabosny. But the child tax credit is one that obviously is not a new issue. It's not the first time we've talked about it here. J.D. Vance was criticized for comments he made on one of the many podcasts he's been on. And in this clip, he's talking about taxing people who don't have kids. And I want to listen. He's talking to Charlie Kirk in this, who is essentially a professional troll. So forget Charlie Kirk's part of this. I want to listen to the substance of what J.D. Vance is saying. And I want you to listen to how J.D. Vance frames the issue of using government to encourage people to have more kids.
Well, I'll go back to something I said earlier about we need to reward the things that we think are good and punish the things that we think are bad. So you talk about tax policy. Let's tax the things that are bad and not tax the things that are good. If you're making $100,000, $400,000 a year, and you've got three kids, you should pay a different lower tax rate than if you're making the same amount of money and you don't have any kids. It's that simple.
I totally agree.
So when this audio came out, even Barstool founder Dave Portnoy, who is, you know, a pretty conservative guy, but he's childless, he lashed out. He called it disgusting, saying he should not have a higher tax rate because he's chosen not to have kids. But I want to give a generous interpretation to these remarks, because Pete, this strikes me that the language he used here, J.D. Vance was using, might have been clumsy or harsh, but maybe it's not substantively all that different from saying he just wants child tax credits back. I mean, is that what he's talking about here, or do you hear something different?
Yeah, so I think there's a lesson that we could all learn to not, you know, maybe play to the host too much of your
sure.
Podcast appearance or things like that. But I would certainly never do that on the radio. But I think, yeah, so his framing there was not the framing that I would take and not the way I would look at the issue. But as a matter of policy, there's a piece of that I do agree with. I think that our tax code should acknowledge that having children are expensive. Children are not contributing to the household income. A family with kids has higher expenses, and, you know, all things being equal, typically than a family who doesn't have children. And to the extent that we can support those families through things like a child tax credit, we are effectively lowering their tax rate, in some cases giving them a tax refund to help with the cost of having kids. And that's a pretty mainstream position for lots of folks. Certainly, it's been the Democratic Party's position for the past couple cycles. A number of Republican senators and Republican governors have supported, and in the case of Republican governors, have signed into law child tax credit expansions. There are child tax credit expansions from both parties in the New York State Legislature right now. So I think there's a broader consensus around the need for families with dependent children to get a little bit of tax relief. I think it's the framing and the sense of being kind of punitive to childless tax filers that that sort of alarms some people when they listen to that. And certainly, again, not the way I would frame that as a public policy.
Yeah, and to be clear also, I mean, if you just take literally what he says in this clip, he's not talking about child tax credits. He's talking about your tax rate. Yeah. And he wants it to be lower if you have kids. And he wants it to be higher if you don't. And he's not talking about a cutoff date when kids are 18. He's kind of implying in perpetuity, that should be your reward. You've contributed children to society. You've got lower taxes. And that carries kind of a mark of permanence. And, you know, I understand why some people recoil a little bit. But when it does come to a child tax credit, he, a few weeks ago, off the cuff, and I remember in a couple of different places, talked about a $5,000 child tax credit. That, to my knowledge, is not part of the Trump-Vance platform. But he's talking about it. The Harris-Walz campaign has talked about a child tax credit. It is popular with the American people when it's polled. Do you expect to see this come back in some form?
Yeah. So right now we have a child tax credit at the federal level that's a maximum of $2,000 per child. Lower income families get less than that. You have to have a minimum earnings amount, and then it kind of grows as you hit a certain income level.
Maybe I should say, do you expect it to be as robust as it was in the pandemic year? Or, you know, what is it, 2020, 2021?
Yeah. So, in 2021, there was an expanded child tax credit, which was $3,600 for young children and $3,000 for kids 6 to 17. Kamala Harris has proposed that we reinstate that and make it permanent. She's also proposed a $6,000 newborn credit. So the first year you file your taxes, and there's some details that aren't out yet, but that she would support a much larger credit for families with you know, babies and newborns, and if they adopt a child, I think there's some different criteria that would entitle you to it. And then J.D. Vance has mentioned this $5,000 credit that he put out in those interviews, but there's no kind of paper on it, so it's hard to review.
But seems to be some momentum for an expanded child tax credit.
And then at the federal level, obviously we talk about lots of different issues and what's going to come up in the next couple of years, and there's foreign policy, and there's Supreme Court justices, who knows what's going to come up in the next presidential administration. But one thing that will almost certainly come up is a lot of the Trump tax cuts are expiring. And included in that is the child tax credit expansion that was part of those tax cuts. So I think the next Congress, the next president, what to do with the child tax credit is going to be a very significant issue at the federal level. And I think some of these proposals, to the extent they're fully fleshed out, are being responsive to that. And there's a sense that the next president, the next Congress will be determining corporate tax rates. They'll be determining, you know, marginal tax rates for the wealthiest Americans. And they'll also be determining the future of the child tax credit and whether it's large or smaller, more generous to low-income families, more generous to middle and upper-income families. That's really the details that's going to get worked out over the next in 2025, really.
Are you an optimist, though, that something's coming?
Yeah, I think from what I've read and, you know, what you see from both parties, I think there's a commitment to doing something to continue, at the very least, the existing child tax credit, which would go down. It would go down to $1,000 if they didn't continue it.
And there's data. You said you've told me the 3,000 and 3,600. There's good data on the impact here. Right?
Yeah. So there's a lot of research done on that credit, and it showed, you know, top line is that it reduced child poverty by around 40% nationally, including in New York. We were about in line with the national numbers, and it had all sorts of positive effects for families in terms of people catching up on rent, people experiencing far less food scarcity. There was a lot of research that showed that people, when they got those monthly child tax credits, partially the psychology of it being framed as a child credit, they spent it on their kids. They bought their kids birthday presents. They bought memberships to zoos. They got their kids clothes for school. They took care of their children with the money they were receiving. And they also were able to take care of some of their household expenses that were really strained, at the time. And so I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests that we should do that. Again, we should commit to as large of a child tax credit as we can afford. And I do think the winners of the next election in November will have a set of decisions around tax policy broadly. But I'm hopeful that they'll they'll find a way to prioritize continued expansions in the child tax credit.
One more bit of policy. We mentioned at the outset here that in Minnesota, Governor Tim Walz signed into law a piece of legislation guaranteeing breakfast and lunch for kids whose families can't provide that. And, you know, some of the criticism that he's received is that's too expensive. You know, there's only so much government can do to feed, to do the job that families should be doing, et cetera. And he has said he'll stand on that record. But has there been movement to seeing that elsewhere? You want to talk a little about what we've seen in New York State, or if even I don't even know if there's a federal model for that kind of a thing. Is that state by state?
Yeah. So school meals are kind of a weird thing. We cover nearly everything else, in terms of public schools. We don't require parents to chip in for the cost of the buses. Sometimes you have to help supplies and things like that. But we don't, we don't charge for recess and things like that. But we have historically charged for meals, particularly for families that don't qualify for free or reduced lunch. And there have been changes over time at the federal and at the state level to that program. But what they did in Minnesota and what they've done in a few other states on the West Coast, I think Colorado, a few others, is they've said, we're going to make those meals free for all children. And the idea behind that is that there are first of all, there's a stigma that you eliminate of some kids are getting the free lunch and they don't have to pay and others do. And that can make it, harder for kids who come up from lower income backgrounds, particularly in schools that are more affluent. So if you're one of very few kids that's qualifying for that free lunch, that can be a tough thing, particularly as the kids get a little older and more sensitive to those things. And there's plenty of research that shows that a lot of families who qualify don't kind of go through the paperwork for it. And so then those kids aren't getting some of the benefits. And again, that could relate to stigma issues. But what they've done in Minnesota and a few other states is say all kids are going to qualify for free lunch. We're going to pay for it through make up the difference between what we get from the federal government with state tax dollars, and schools are just going to provide meals to kids. And that's a much more efficient way. It cuts down a ton of paperwork and administrative burdens for school districts and for families. And it helps kids, have a full stomach when they're trying to learn. New York, we've done like a couple steps in that direction. So a lot of school districts do have what's called community eligibility. We have that at RCSD. We have it in a number of other districts where every kid in that school gets free breakfast and lunch because the school has a certain level of need. And in the state budget 2 years ago, there was an expansion of that program to cover more districts, but not every district. And so if you are typically living, in a more, middle class or more affluent school district, there's still, people are paying for lunches and all. And it's something we should do. There's been a lot of work at the state level. There's some of our delegation here in Rochester has been very supportive of it. A lot of Republicans representing rural districts are very supportive of it because they see it's in the school districts that they go visit when they're out in their community, that it's something that those districts are struggling with. And so New York's taken some steps in that direction. We're not all the way there yet, and we should get there this next budget season.
It is expensive, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a cost to it, certainly. I forget. I don't have it in front of me, but it was, it was north of I think it was $100-some-odd million for New York State to implement it across the board. And, that's a decision we'd have to make. We spent money on different things, but we could do it. We have the resources. We're a wealthy state. We can provide this for kids in the state.
Patrick writes, I'm a daycare baby born and raised in Rochester from the age of two or three until first or second grade at the Register Children's Network and then at school number 12. Then I was able to walk 2 miles back to my house or get picked up after school at number 12. My grandparents were just from a different generation. My parents both worked full-time and had good, solid careers. They are now retired. They're spending a lot of time with my daughter, who is going on 3 in November, and after they've worked so hard their entire lives, the cultural expectation would be that they have to raise my daughter for me while I'm out at work. That sounds like privilege, spoon-feeding us a bunch of expletive. It's from Patrick. So Patrick's not down with the possible cultural change here in the direction away from daycare, not subsidizing childcare, not funding more daycare and childcare, but pressuring families to rely on parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles. Okay, thank you, Patrick. I appreciate that. And as we close here, about a minute left here, Pete, do you think the national discourse is healthier than it was a decade ago on this issue, or do you think that we're kind of stuck in a, how healthy do you think the discourse is right now?
Well, I think it's good that these issues are coming up. I think we've had these challenges for a long time, and we it wasn't getting as much attention as certainly folks like me would have hoped it would. I'd like to think, trying to be a little kumbaya-ish here, that the folks in all parties, all perspectives are have an interest in supporting families and in helping kids get off to the best possible start to life. And there's differences of opinion on how to do so. And I think there are insights across the board and on all sides of the issue. And so I think it's good that these things are coming up. You don't like the language that's sometimes used, or the sort of judgment of different decisions that people are making. Certainly, that's not something I try to do when I'm talking about these issues. But we need to talk these things out. We need to have a conversation about these things so that we can, figure out what's the steps forward, both in terms of government policy and as people are making decisions in their own lives. So it's I think it's a healthy thing for us to be talking about this and not some of the other topics that are out there.
Well,
sometimes.
You know, we'll get back to those other topics. And, we've been focusing on federal issues. So much of what the Children's Agenda does also looks at, local and state issues. And Pete Nabosny, as policy director, is generous with his time. Come back, you and your colleagues as well. I want to ask you about no-fault divorce again. We'll talk about all kinds of other things.
Anytime, as long as we don't cover that. Thanks.
That's Pete Nabosny from the Children's Agenda. We got more connections coming up in a moment.